From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben, you are you, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. In the beginning of our opening notes for this episode, I had a relatively lame open-ended question, but I believe in it, and I want to know, what's on your mind? How are you guys feeling today?
Are you trying to set up the topic?
Originally I was when I wrote
that
down.
You really want to know?
Yeah, I really
want to
know.
What's
going on with you guys? Yeah.
Just the general state of affairs in the country, the world, you know, base level fear and paranoia. But other than that, not too bad.
Yeah. Feeling pretty good today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It looked like it was going to storm. I haven't seen any rain yet. So, hey. It's a bright new day.
You're keeping it light.
Yeah.
So it's weird because that's such a common phrase in English, and it's a very common sentiment in all of humanity. People will say, hey, what's on your mind, as though your mind is some sort of object, like a table upon which things can be placed, you know? And today we're also touching on a question that has baffled, confounded, perplexed, and infuriated people throughout history, which is what is a mind?
You know?
Is when we say a mind, are we saying that we are observing a consciousness? You know?
Like, are we talking about just the brain itself and its functions?
Mm-hmm. Right. And maybe just for setup here, let's explore the idea of consciousness, because you told us a pretty impressive and fascinating quotation earlier before we went on the air.
Yes. A gentleman named Daniel Dennett, who is a philosopher. I can't speak for him, but I would say he thinks of himself as a philosopher / cognitive scientist. And he gave a TED Talk in 2007, and he had this to say on the idea of what is a consciousness. He says that what we are is approximately 100 trillion little cellular robots. He says that's what we're made out of. No other ingredients. We're just made of cells. And not one of those cells is conscious, and not a single one of those cares who you are or knows that you are a thing. He says somehow he and everybody else in his field, they have to explain, or at least they're tasked with explaining, how you put together these groups of cells, of trillions of cells, if you group them into what he calls armies and battalions, how do these little robotic unconscious cells, how do they become us? How do they create ideas? How do they create memories and colors? How do we see colors from these cells? And then what does that mean? Like, is that consciousness if you can observe those things and think about those things? And then he ended that thought with just somehow all of the content, all of the consciousness that we experience is accomplished by the busy activity of these hordes of neurons that are in our brain that are just firing and storing information through connections. Pretty crazy. And
yeah.
The biggest thing is he says is, how is this possible? Like, how could that be?
I really appreciate that, because it makes me think of our examination of biomes, you know, or microbiomes,
mm-hmm.
rather, where we see that there's an entire world in somebody's digestive system,
yeah.
right? And I think the first time I learned about that was when we were doing an episode of our show Brain Stuff on farts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also shout out to Le Petelman, the professional flatulist. Story for another day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting a hard side eye from Noel on this one. Sorry,
hard, man.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. Noel. I know.
You know how I feel about farts in the podcast studio.
It's
for real. A very sensitive subject, because it's a very small room.
It is.
The concept of consciousness. How is it possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is a mind? People have generated multiple interpretations, suppositions about this. And when we started digging into this, we were inspired, but we also thought, this is a lot. This is a lot of weird stuff to unpack and explore. And luckily, we were able to contact one of our recurring guests, a longtime friend of the show, ladies and gentlemen, Joe McCormick, co-host of Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Great. Now that you're here.
God, we were really bummed out before you walked
in. A little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for walking in and saving the day.
Well, he just lights
y'all
up
are just
going
to continue pretending that I wasn't sitting here the whole time.
What are you talking about? You weren't sitting here.
I was not conscious of it.
Yeah.
So obviously it sounds like you guys want to talk about consciousness today.
I guess.
And we actually did a two-parter on consciousness recently on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Not so much on the problem of consciousness broadly, because how could you cover that in a single episode? It's a topic that comes up over and over again on our show. It's one of the most perplexing questions in all of science and the philosophy of mind. What is consciousness and where does it come from? Mm-hmm. And I like that you brought up that Daniel Dennett quote, Matt, because it calls to mind the problem of the heap. You all know about like the heapness problem. If you have one grain of sand, that's not a heap. And if you have two grains of sand, that's not a heap. But at some point, you keep adding grains of sand and a heap of sand emerges.
Mm-hmm.
At what point does the heap happen? It's hard to pick a number, isn't it?
Yeah. What's the threshold? Yeah.
Yeah. And a similar kind of problem arises from the problem of consciousness, that we know to some degree consciousness is created by brains that are processing information. One experiment you can do to sort of prove this to yourself is go under general anesthesia. If you go under general anesthesia, the information processing in your brain is suppressed and you have complete blackout. It's absolute loss of consciousness for the time that you're out.
I only podcast while completely blacked out.
That's all true. Yeah.
So you come back from that, you regain your consciousness and you think, wow, okay, so it's possible for my brain to exist and all those cells to be there, but when they're not doing something, my consciousness ceases.
Where are they?
But here's a much creepier version. It seems that those cells in your brain can be doing a lot of stuff without generating consciousness. I want to see if you guys have ever been in this scenario.
Okay.
You ever gotten to a destination and parked your car and then realized like, oh my God, I was not conscious while I was driving here. Mm-hmm.
What happened? It's a blur. You remember, let's call it point A, mm-hmm. which was your last significant memory before the drive.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there's a missing gap and you're at you feel like you're at point B, but it may be point H, point J. You know, many things have happened. And you have this sort of localized amnesia.
Yeah, just the feeling that did I actually drive here? Because you were probably lost in thought in, you know, one section or several sections of your brain working together in that conscious part where you're paying attention to what my arms are doing and what my feet are doing. It's almost like it wasn't happening.
Well, I would imagine too, like with rote kind of mindless activities like that, this is easier than, let's say, you know, something like spending time with a loved one or like generating new memories and things like that.
Exactly, Noel. So that's the important thing, is the rote repetitious aspect of it. So on these types of activities like driving or, say, you know, other household chores,
having
sometimes
boring sex,
mowing the lawn.
Didn't expect it to go that way. Nope. Yeah, mowing the lawn.
Mowing the lawn is our show's euphemism for boring sex.
Okay. Well, yeah, any of these repetitive activities, yeah, you can like totally lose consciousness and yet your mind is still working. Think about all the stuff your brain has to be doing to drive you from one place to another. It's got to take in visual information and auditory information.
Constantly.
Yeah. Constantly updating your mental model of what the road is, where you need to go. It's got to coordinate all your muscles with timing being very precise.
Mm-hmm. Physical feedback from the wheel.
Yeah. This is complex behavior without you being present in your mind for it to happen.
Ah, one point of order. Just a quick interjection. In addition to this, our brains are also keeping the entire human ship running, right? So many bodily processes that we are not consciously aware of. There's a thing that used to happen to me when I was a kid. I would lay awake at night and I was too conscious of my breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, if I don't forget that I've been breathing the whole time, if I keep concentrating on it, then what if it just stops? You know, I just to add to the point, it does seem mind-boggling when we think about it, how many things, not just when we're driving, but just existing, happen.
Yeah, tons of what we do is unconscious. Your brain constantly regulates activity within the body unconsciously. The regulation and release of hormones, neurotransmitter reuptake, digestion, all this kind of stuff is going on, your brain telling your body what to do, but you not being conscious of it. Meanwhile, you're very conscious of, say, most of the running and jumping you do, and sometimes conscious of breathing. Why is that? Do you ever think about that? How come evolution created an animal that has conscious control of running and jumping, unconscious control of digestion, and optionally conscious control of breathing? What if you had to consciously control your heart rate and your digestion, but unconsciously moved about through the world?
The thought of that is making my heart rate speed up right now.
Anyway, that's kind of a weird thing to ponder. Yeah. I mean, you can start to think of like evolutionary reasons why one might be selected for more than the other, but that also is interesting because it gives you reasons that consciousness might be biologically adaptive, that it could actually be useful for something. And that's a big question in all these debates about consciousness. Does consciousness actually do anything, or is it just a helpless observer of what the body would be doing anyway? But I want to go back to the road analogy.
Okay.
There we are. We're on the road.
All right. So you are in this highway hypnosis state. You're driving from one place to another. You, for some reason, why ever this happens, I'm not quite sure, but you are not conscious of what's going on. You're just somewhere else. And your body is driving on its own, controlled by your brain, but not by your mind. Suddenly, along the way, let's say you're coming to work.
Okay.
And along I-75 or wherever you'd be traveling, you get to a place where there is a giant pit in the middle of the freeway, and the god Molech is down there in the pit accepting infant sacrifices.
Ooh.
And it's completely blocking your path to get to work.
Okay. Yeah.
What would happen then?
Well, then you would experience a moment of sudden lucidity, right?
Yeah, you'd snap out of it. You'd come out of that highway hypnosis state, and what would happen next?
You'd offer your allegiance to Moloch.
No. Don't do that.
What?
He's don't cool. ever do that.
Come on.
Matt,
I didn't realize we were split on Molech in here.
Well, sacrificing babies.
It's
fine.
We're all close friends, but part of being good friends with someone is that you accept that you don't always agree. And Moloch is one of those things that is relatively divisive on our show. I just want to be candid.
So we're snapped back to reality.
Right.
Boom. Mm. Here comes gravity.
But why do you – nice. So why do you snap back? Why do you snap back, Nolan?
Because
there's a threat or there's danger.
Yeah, you got to figure out what to do.
Right.
That suddenly that starts to become a point where you can see what your consciousness is being used for, that it has some kind of biological function. Suddenly, so you have all these activities that you can do and your body can carry out and your brain can regulate without your consciousness, even things as complex as driving. But suddenly, when you've got to make a decision, when there is novel stimuli that you did not expect to encounter and it doesn't seem to fit with your, you know, rote conditioned behaviors, then suddenly you have to use your consciousness to make a decision and figure out what to do next.
Yeah.
So this reaction to that novel idea brings you back to the present moment, and you begin do you begin reevaluating the existing stimuli?
Well, I mean, think about what would happen in your own mind. I can say for me, I think what I would start to do is I would say, okay, I can't go this way. So I need to figure out what's the other way to get to work. And I would imagine in my mind sort of a map of the city and think, what are the alternate routes I could use and how would I get to them?
So it'd be like modeling.
Yeah. I mean, do y'all disagree?
No, I don't disagree, but I'm also wondering what happens when your base level is constantly presenting you with unexpected things, and that becomes the norm. Like if you're a soldier, for example, like in a foxhole or like in a war zone, and you constantly have to be shifting and adjusting and, you know, looking out for threats, and there's so many of them that it's basically the norm.
Well, I mean, in that case, you were probably in a state of heightened awareness constantly, which probably leads to anxiety and stress, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be very stressful to have too many demands placed upon your consciousness, right? Like sometimes we kind of want to slip into that unconscious state. It's relaxing.
Decision fatigue.
Yeah.
Right? It's a real thing. And so, okay, so I love this exploration right now. Mullick has appeared on I-75 and we're driving to work and we say, oh, and we snap out of it and we say, okay, well, maybe if I get off at the 14th Street exit, there won't be too much traffic and I'll be a little bit late and everybody will understand because it's Mullick again.
Right. But here's a question. What if you couldn't do that? The part where you snap back and come to your consciousness mm-hmm. and you make a model in your mind of how to get to work. What if your mind was not capable of any of that? What if you were a being for whom every activity in your life was in that unconscious autopilot state that we get into sometimes when highway hypnosis or when you're mowing the lawn, any of these things that you just do without thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be possible for a being to exist in a permanent state like that? It seems like it could be possible, right?
Yeah, I feel pretty close to that every once in a while.
Well, there are also quite a few mammals who appear to behave that way. You know, I guess, is this in any way related to metacognition, you know, thinking about thinking?
Yeah, metacognition is often associated with the basis of consciousness. I mean, people have all kinds of debates about what consciousness exactly is, and we're obviously not going to settle that question today. But metacognition, which thinking about thinking or regulating your own thinking, having the idea of not just having a thought, but thinking about the fact that you had a thought, mm-hmm. is often what consciousness consists of. In some models, at least.
So would it be possible to – and what would that be like to not think about thinking?
Well, I mean, it seems like it would be okay for lots of tasks. I mean, you could get through a lot of your life without thinking about thinking until you hit these novel stimuli moments where you needed to make a decision and think about sort of like you needed to do some internal simulation and modeling, like picturing that map in your head and trying to figure out how to get there. When instinct and conditioning won't suffice, what do you do? Now, here's where we're going to get to the book that is at the center of today's conversation. So recently on Stuff to Blow Your Mind, my co-host Robert Lamb and I did a couple of episodes on the concept of bicameralism, which was introduced in 1976 by the American psychologist Julian Jaynes in his book The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And I gotta say at the outset, this is one of the most fascinating books I've ever read.
Wow.
It makes an argument about the nature of consciousness and about the history of consciousness in the human species that ultimately I think is probably wrong. Like I probably don't agree with it,
mm-hmm.
but it is a fascinating hypothesis to explore with him because he pulls from so many different disciplines with tons of thoughtfulness and evidence, and it's just a really fascinating ride to go on.
And it made quite a stir when it came out. I mean, it was pretty popular for a, you know, what ultimately is an academic work, right?
Yeah, it's gotten a lot of attention over the years in weird, odd kind of smatterings. Like, it is actually not something that has been revisited a whole lot in the scientific or academic literature. One of the things that's frustrating about it is, okay, so it introduces – and we'll get to what the hypothesis is mm-hmm. in just a second. I hate to keep teasing you, but it introduces this fascinating radical hypothesis about the history of consciousness, tries to offer some evidence for it, and seems to make some predictions about what would be found in the future. So what you really want is for a bunch of scientists to start testing what would be predicted by this hypothesis and see if it's true. The testing of its predictions has been somewhat slim. There, mm-hmm. there have been a few studies that have mentioned it, some favorably, some unfavorably. But I guess the best we could say is that it remains controversial. So this is in no way considered a widely accepted hypothesis. But a lot of philosophers and scientists do consider it interesting and valuable, even if it's not necessarily correct.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you point this out. There might be slim testing, but there's nothing definitive either way.
Right.
There's no absolutely yes, absolutely no.
Well, I think a few neurologists have said, look, modern neuroscience disproves his claims, but others don't necessarily agree. So I think what I should just do now is start by giving you the straightforward version of Jane's conclusion, and then we can turn back to explaining it a little more.
Yeah, yeah. So bicameral mind in a nutshell.
Yeah. So Julian Jayne's hypothesis in this book is that until about 3,000 years ago, human beings, meaning our species, Homo sapiens, was not conscious. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of odd. Like, how do you imagine that? Because there has not been significant biological evolution in 3,000 years, and, mm-hmm. you know, since about 1,000 BC. So what could have happened? We'll get to that. So he says that around 1,000 BCE, modern human consciousness, meaning our awareness of awareness, our internal ability to narratize, like we were talking about in that example, mm-hmm. it began as a cultural invention, probably in Mesopotamia, that spread across the world. And before that time, for a long time, for thousands of years before about 1000 BCE, almost all humans were not conscious in the way we were, but were commanded in all novel behaviors by hallucinated voices that they called gods.
Let's let that sink in. Yeah. That's insane. So in this understanding, if we have Matt driving up I-75, he sees this ancient god, he doesn't think, boy, I've got to take the exit to 14th Street. Instead, he hears something.
What if he hears the voice of Moloch telling him, watch out for Moloch right there?
He might think so.
Sacrificing that baby.
Yeah, he might think so.
No, just, I mean, I'm
afraid if I overcomplicated this by introducing Moloch into the example, but.
No, but I mean, my question though is like, this is not figurative. This is like, the hypothesis is that there is an auditory hallucination of a voice. This is not like, you know, a metaphor.
There's no self-association.
Exactly. No. That is exactly what he's saying. He's literally saying that before about 1,000 years ago, people were not conscious. They did not have the ability to snap out of the hypnotized state and think about what they would do. Instead, what happened is they stayed in the hypnotized state their entire lives. And when some kind of novel stimuli arose, something that could not be dealt with on basic instinct and conditioned behaviors, like when we're mowing the lawn, when that happened, a voice would tell them what to do, and they would hear the voice audibly within their head.
And then be commanded, I guess, by the voice.
And they would obey ineluctably. They would obey in the sense that Jayne talks in the book about instinctual obedience, like how in, you know, social animal species, when there is a dominant individual, that you can really very strongly control people's behavior by
his master's voice.
Yeah, by displaying these dominant sort of signals and getting up in somebody's space and telling them what to do very firmly, people tend to obey. And so he says that this sort of instinct, the tendency to obey, is internalized, and it turns into the temporal lobe of the non-dominant hemisphere of the brain. So in most people, that's going to be the right hemisphere.
Sure.
If you are a right-handed person, the non-dominant hemisphere is going to be the right hemisphere. The temporal lobe of the non-dominant hemisphere generating this auditory hallucination and commanding the dominant hemisphere what to do. So part of the question would be, how does the non-dominant hemisphere know what to do? And you would say there that what appears to be happening is that the non-dominant hemisphere in Jayne's model is the place where the integration and synthesis of information is taking place. So it's doing the kind of judgment part that we would normally do consciously. Like you would put together a bunch of stuff in your mind, some pictures and some words mm-hmm. and some ideas, and say, okay, here's what I need to do. Instead of all that happening consciously, this would happen unconsciously, isolated in the right hemisphere, delivered as an auditory hallucination to the left hemisphere.
So would this, without getting too far into the technical details, would this activity, the synthesis, also include memory of past events?
Now, here's an interesting thing. You have to imagine what memory would consist of if you did not have the ability to be conscious.
Right.
I don't think we have the space today to fully discuss exactly what Jayne's theory of consciousness is, because it's a complex thing. Essentially, for him, I'll try to give you the simple version. For Jayne's, consciousness is based on language. He says that you couldn't be conscious without having a language. So there are some kind of disturbing takeaways from this. One of them is that it's impossible for, say, animals to be conscious if they don't really have a language that's capable. Here's the key part of generating metaphors. So metaphors are sort of the ultimate workhorse of what language is. It's when you describe an unknown thing in terms of a known thing.
One of my favorite quotes from that is from a quotes pertaining to that is a throwaway joke or observation in the television show Community. A metaphor is a thought wearing another thought's hat.
That's a good one, man.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing about metaphor is even the word metaphor is a metaphor.
Yeah.
The word metaphor comes from Greek. It means to carry across. So it takes this unknown concept of the abstract idea of taking the definition of one word and using it to help understand another word.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes that from the literal act of carrying something from one place to another. So the word metaphor is a metaphor.
Well, and what's more meta than consciousness? I mean, like the ability – consciousness basically is the ability to extend our understanding of reality and kind of wrap it in a sort of digestible form where we can think about the past. We can think about the future.
Yes.
We can think about the present all at the same time.
That is Jane's theory. So Jane says consciousness is a place. It is a metaphorical mind space based on the analogy of real space. Now, that might sound kind of hard to understand for a second, or it might take a second to set in. But when you start testing that against your experience, at least for me, I often find that that's true. In the same way that the meaning of the word metaphor is this abstract thing that's taken from the literal physical action of carrying something from one place to another, consciousness for Jane's is this abstract space that is based on the metaphor of real space.
And when I was reading up on this too, the idea of that God voice, we've basically subsumed that into this kind of unspoken voice, unheard voice that is our consciousness. So it's like we don't hear the voice, but we've absorbed that essentially into our ability to, you know, process all of this stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. So here's one thing. A bicameral person and a conscious person might not necessarily do different things in the same situation, right? They might both come to the hole in the freeway, see the god Molech, not know what to do for a second, and then take the same route to get around to work. The only difference is how the brain organizes and integrates and delivers that information. Now, there might be other cases where a conscious person and a bicameral person would do something different.
Mm-hmm. And before we get too lost on this point, there is another disturbing implication. I want to plant the seed here for our exploration, and that is that if Jane's is correct, when we're following this line of reasoning, language is a pre-existing necessity for the development of consciousness,
right?
Which means that language predates consciousness and the
yes.
way we would understand it.
Yes.
And so that is, to me, that is a real stereotype buster, because we associate language, whether written or spoken, with this act of consciousness, of awareness.
Yeah, you know? I mean, this is a super radical hypothesis. I mean, when I look at this and I say, I find it interesting, but I don't believe it, it's not necessarily because I have found any of his particular arguments very faulty. Most of his arguments are, I feel like, are moderately to strongly persuasive. It's just that it goes so strongly against what you would tend to think is the base assumption that if there is such a thing as consciousness, it's a biological invention based on how brains work rather than a cultural invention made possible by language. But one other thing I should mention just to make clear is also his idea about how the evolution of consciousness comes across. So basically you have to imagine in human history, there's a three-stage evolution where human primates, first without language, are like he imagines animals are, which are just stimulus response machines.
Automatons.
Yeah, automata. That humans like us that had very powerful brains, brains just as biologically powerful as ours, capable of as many calculations and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. they were just working on instinct and conditioning.
Which
is, and that's it.
That's pretty frightening, right?
Because yeah, it's hard to imagine that.
Does that mean agriculture as well? Does that mean other things we consider completely human inventions, you know, like cooking, hunting? Does that exist before consciousness?
No, I mean, hunting I think probably does. But once we get to agriculture, that's the next stage. So you've got the animal stage where we're just stimulus response machines. Then the evolution of language makes possible the transition to bicamerality. Bicamerality comes after this stage, and that's when we're in the state where we're still not conscious yet, but we're hearing these hallucinated voices. And then in the third stage, about 3,000 years ago, we make the final transition to modern human consciousness, where we have the ability to narratize in this metaphorical mind space.
Well, here we are. I think that's a good place to take a quick break, and then we'll dive into that metaphorical mind space.
And we're back. This is already such a head trip, you guys. I think we've got a pretty good 40,000 foot view, right? We understand some of the basic differentiators. And now if you'd be so kind, Joe, I know that everybody listening is wondering, what evidence does Janes base these claims on, or what does he draw from? Because you mentioned that it's a far-reaching argument.
Yes, so it's a very multidisciplinary approach. He draws from the history of literature, he draws from archaeology, he draws from anthropology and understanding ancient religions and societies. He draws from neurology, from studying the function in different regions of the brain. That might be one of the most limited areas, because he was writing back in 1976. We know more about regions of the brain now than we did then, but we still knew a decent amount then. And like I said, the picture is not clear to me what neurology since then has had to say about his hypothesis. It seems that there are some results that sort of go against it and others that sort of go in favor of it. So I don't know if that helps us in one direction yet. But then also psychology, of course, which was his own field.
Mm-hmm.
So I might go to one of his primary examples of how ancient literature would inform this, because literature is a great place to look for evidence of consciousness. You can just look at the characters and see, are the characters conscious? Do they introspect? Do they have the ability to narratize in mind space? Here is a really crazy thing that I never noticed before, but Janes makes this argument pretty strongly. I've asked in our audience to see if anybody with expertise in the classics, you know, in ancient Greek literature, can contradict what he has to say. I haven't had any takers yet, but he makes the argument pretty convincingly that the characters of Homer's The Iliad are not conscious.
Yeah, this was the mind-blowing thing for me as well, because again, I'm learning about what a high pedestal we place the concept of consciousness on. Mm-hmm. The understanding of something like one of the world's most famous works of literature,
yeah,
is that it must inherently be made by
conscious thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when you picture the writer, I picture a person in thought. I picture a person who is consciously introspecting about what to write next. But you have to imagine that literature before the conscious period, if this is true, we're just entertaining it
sure.
for the sake of argument.
We're what-ifing.
Yeah, we're what-ifing. If there were such a thing as a bicameral period, what would the writing process of a bicameral author be like? This is a person who does not have the power to introspect or narratize in a mind space.
It would be transcription, right?
Exactly. It would be essentially taking transcription from literature that is compiled and integrated unconsciously by the right brain in most people, by the non-dominant hemisphere.
Wow, it sounds like there's a plan almost.
and so you would see examples of this in, say, how the ancient act of composition is described. Here's something kind of creepy. What if you took some of what appears to be the literary conventions of ancient literature just literally? How about Sing to me, O Muse, the song of all these Greek poems starting with the invocation of the Muse.
Oh, wow.
Now, we usually look at that as a literary device. We say, okay, they're just being metaphorical. They're saying, like, I'm trying to get into the mood about writing. I want some, you know, I need this introspective juice. And so that's my metaphor. This God, the Muse, is my metaphor. What if you just take them at their word? They're asking the God to start telling them what to write.
That's amazing.
Well, but I mean, it also – it doesn't – it's not too far of a jump from the way we think of ancient civilizations and the way they treat gods and act as though all things come directly as a result of their relationship with God. And it's very specific. It's like my crops grow because I did this thing.
Yes.
And the gods made it so.
Yes.
It's not figurative in any way.
And it's not just these external activities like what allows the crops to grow, what changes the weather. It's internalized influence of the gods that we see in Jane's interpretation of the Iliad. So he looks at the Iliad and he says – I'm looking through this thing and trying to find places where characters are introspecting. He says there's maybe a couple of places, and these appear to be later additions to the text added by scribes long after it was first composed. If you look at the original version of the text and what appears to be its oldest parts, characters do not make decisions by internal introspection. When novel stimuli arise, a god shows up and tells them what to do. So Achilles is about to strike down Agamemnon. He's like, I don't know what to do. I'm so angry. I'm going to attack my king. And then a god shows up, grabs him by the hair, and says, don't do it. And then repeated again and again throughout this ancient epic poem, whenever people are faced with novel stimuli, a god shows up, says, do this, and they do it.
So, as you said, ineluctably, right?
Yeah.
And so there's one thing that really stuck out to me about this, where Jaynes claims there is no concept of will nor a word for it.
No.
In the Iliad.
I sure do remember thinking that the Odyssey was a hell of a lot more interesting than the Iliad when I was a kid.
And he makes that contrast. Yeah. I mean, the Odyssey seems to have a lot more evidence of consciousness within it than the Iliad does, for Jaynes at least.
There's inner torment in the Odyssey.
Yeah.
The characters develop. So with a lot of his claims with the Iliad in particular dwell on some word usage.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So Jaynes points out that in the Iliad, there are a number of words in the ancient Greek vocabulary that if you look to later texts have meanings that are clearly associated with consciousness and conscious introspection, but as deployed in the Iliad mean something else.
Mm-hmm.
They have these corporeal non-conscious meanings. For example, the word psihe, like our word psyche. In later centuries, he says this, you know, you can find it all throughout Greek literature. It means consciousness or mind or soul. But in the Iliad, he's like, it looks like this is just referring to sort of life fluids like blood or breath.
Mm-hmm.
The word thumos, he says, in later centuries, you look through Greek literature and this appears to me to mean something like emotional mind or soul. In the Iliad, he says it means something more like motion, like when a soldier dies on the field, the thumos goes out of their arms and legs.
Mm-hmm.
The word nous, which he says in later Greek literature appears to mean something like conscious mind or consciousness. In the Iliad, he says it means like field of vision. So if you can see something, it's in your nous.
Wow.
Kind of freaky, huh?
It really is.
And Zeus holds Zeus holds Odysseus in his noose.
Yeah, he holds him in his eyes.
In his Zeus noose.
Yeah.
Zeus's noose is loose.
The noose of Zeus.
Mm. I mean, it's
like
kind of –
Dr. Zeus, but sorry.
No. I mean, it's kind of creepy to imagine, isn't it?
It is. No, it is. And I mean, it's like – it's all entirely practical and functional stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's like literally, this is what I see, this is how I interact with it. And yet, there is still like this mystical element to it where we're being fed instructions by these like deities. So
well,
it's fascinating counterpoint.
Where there's no agency.
And it goes straight back to Jane's idea of consciousness being a metaphor based on physical space, because, or physical actions in physical space, because think about how often often in your consciousness you express conscious content or conscious behavior with the metaphor of vision.
Mm-hmm.
Like when somebody is explaining something to you and you don't get it and then you finally consciously comprehend it, I see.
Yeah, or having vision,
yeah.
Having a vision, being like someone that has foresight that can take a top-down view of something mentally.
Yeah. Oh, and oracles have a part to play in our story later.
Oh, yeah.
So this also maybe calls to mind for some of us the concept of like soma or sarx or pneuma, you know. There's the word soma that eventually comes to mean body, right? But it's always in the plural in Homer, and it just means dead limbs of a corpse.
And now there's a drug called Soma that gives you dead limbs like a corpse.
Yeah.
Carisoprodol.
Is that the name?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Wow.
You were ready with that one.
Have you been waiting to drop that one?
Yeah, for about 3 months.
That's why you were grinning.
Yeah.
The whole past 3 months.
I knew it was coming.
So –
you have vision.
So obviously his exploration of the Iliad is just one of the many historical avenues that Janes goes down in his book. There's no way for us to explore all of them here.
Mm-hmm.
If you want more detail, you can read his book or you can go listen to the two episodes that Robert Lamb and I did on Stuff to Blow Your Mind where we go a lot more into – we still don't cover everything, but mm-hmm. a lot of the different examples he discusses from history. Some of the other things he brings up are, for example, the theocratic organization of ancient society. When you look at the rulers of many ancient kingdoms, it is just almost ubiquitous that the king is a god or a representative of a god.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what if instead of thinking about that metaphorically or as some kind of tool of social control, we just took it literally and said, okay, what they're saying about the role of the king is correct. The god tells the king what to do, and then the king commands the people.
We are all ruled by this non-dominant temporal lobe.
Exactly. The king's right hemisphere, or if the king was left-handed, the non-dominant hemisphere of the king is presenting to the king as a god, telling the king what to do, and that is being interpreted by the king's dominant hemisphere as instructions that must be carried out and delivered on as commands to the people.
And if that's the case, there's another interesting twist here. If that's the case, it explains why gods often only appear to the person they are interacting with, right? The person they are commanding.
Yeah. So think about this in the history of religions. Early religions seem to have a lot of direct interaction with idols and with God experiences directly. I mean, if you read about the religious phenomenology of the most ancient religions in the world, people talk constantly about conversations with the gods where the gods tell them what to do. And they talk about going to see the gods. Oftentimes these are represented as idols. Like, mm-hmm. and part of Jane's theory is that idols were things created to just help people trigger their hallucinations. When they wanted information, they could put themselves in an altered state of consciousness by interacting with these idols that would get the hallucinations going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see that, and then you see this transition to other kinds of religion. It's not that people used to be more religious and now they're less religious. Religion just seems to be a very different kind of thing later on. So in the last 2,000 years or so, you start to see these religions based on things like faith and dogma,
mm-hmm.
which if you imagine a bicameral world, even though everybody's believing in gods, what's the role for something like faith in there? Like you don't need to be told to believe in a doctrine or something. It's just like you're talking to the gods all the time. There's no need for faith.
And you're doing what they say instantly.
Yeah.
Faith sort of inherently incorporates the idea of overcoming doubt.
Yeah, exactly. And especially law, written law. This is a big thing for Janes where he talks about how one of the major factors precipitating the transition from the bicameral mind to the conscious mind is, well, one thing he points out, calamity. So there will be these widespread disasters and the late Bronze Age collapse and all that that caused problems in the way society was working that sort of put pressures on people and forced them to find new ways to structure their minds in order to live.
Mm-hmm.
But the other major influence he highlights is literature. And literature would include written law. Think about how the presence of a written law would undermine your relationship with the gods that tell you what to do.
Yeah, if there's any kind of conflict there,
yeah.
Which side do you choose?
Yeah, and so he actually argues that there are probably going to be these periods where, say, within one particular religious tradition, there would be a conflict between the conscious people who are trying to practice the conscious version of that religion and the bicameral people who are trying to practice the bicameral version of that religion. He gives one example from the Old Testament where he says, you know, there are these passages in the Old Testament in the Hebrew Bible where it says you really should not tolerate anybody who has an ob. What does that mean, this word ob? And he says that what he thinks this word means is like familiar spirit. Meaning that there could have been at the time a brotherhood of conscious priests who were trying to enforce the conscious version of the religion and saw the people who were trying to practice their bicameral hallucinated voice version of the religion as blasphemous and causing trouble within their control over what faith and doctrine was.
Does this tie into monotheism at that point as well?
Well, yeah, it'd be hard to have monotheism under bicamerality. You could imagine that if the bicameral world transitioning into a conscious world, you'd probably see a concurrent transition away from polytheism and toward monotheism, which kind of does line up with the timeline we see.
So you can see how fascinating this is and how easily this becomes a very, very deep rabbit hole. But we would be remiss if we did not point out that there is also a lot of criticism here.
You know? Sure. I mean, there are tons of reasons to doubt this. I mean, one would just be to say, well, okay, he puts a lot of interesting evidence on the table, but a statement this radical, you know, mm-hmm. a hypothesis this radical doesn't really get anywhere until it makes predictions about things yet unknown that we find out are in fact correct. And so I would say it has not yet met that burden.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it has predicted much that we've discovered. Oh, yeah, it's true. One thing that might be interesting would be if we discover whole caches of ancient documents that we've never found before. You know, archaeologists turn up ancient literature that's previously undiscovered, and we find a transition along the lines of what he claims is there for the Iliad and the Odyssey. So if we see, you know, 4,000-year-old literature or, you know, 3,500-year-old literature having all these words that later on we know in these languages mean things about consciousness and in context do not mean anything about consciousness, I'd say that's a good prediction confirmed that we're seeing more things line up with the timeline of literature not reflecting consciousness and then later reflecting consciousness.
Why do you think there's no effort to do that kind of analysis?
I don't know. I mean, I've seen some people try to look at other ancient works of literature and say, you know, how much introspective content is there? But mm-hmm. I don't know that anybody's really gone that deep on it yet. I mean, there might be a study out there I'm not aware of, but
there's also a heap of not to make a heap problem, but there's also a heap of differing constraints. If we're talking literature of that age, mm-hmm. then it may be radically different in one place for entirely unrelated reasons.
Well, right. I mean, so think about the alternatives. Let's just assume that the bicameral hypothesis is not correct,
okay.
and that people have always been conscious. And yet at the same time, let's just take Jaynes as correct in his argument that those words in the Iliad don't reflect any conscious content. What would explain that? That's an interesting problem in itself. How come these conscious people creating an ancient work of literature did not put any consciousness into the work?
That's a fascinating question. I've got to ban myself from using the word fascinating for at least the rest of this episode. And in this exploration, I guess one of the big questions people would run into is, okay, this is fascinating. Even the people who criticize Jaynes and disagree with the idea say, wow, what an interesting thing.
You know
thing.
That's Matt's word.
what an interesting proposal.
What a brain-raking proposal.
There we go. You got the double ooh. That's pretty rare. Got to earn that one. But to what end? Where does this lead us? What are the implications? How does this exist in the modern world?
Ah, but not so fast, Ben. First, we're going to hear from our sponsor.
We've returned. Some of the implications that are pretty clear here is the idea that religion is related to internal hallucinations, which may seem offensive to some people at this time. We're not advocating this. We are saying it's the argument, right?
Well, I mean, Jaynes wouldn't necessarily say that modern religions are related to internal hallucinations. Mm-hmm. I think he would have said that the ancient religions of the bicameral peoples, but as we were talking about earlier, modern religion is just very different. I mean, just descriptively very different from the kinds of religion that you would imagine would have been practiced by bicameral people.
And what are some vestiges, if they exist?
Well, one thing that would be quite obvious that Jaynes points out is the condition of schizophrenia.
Okay.
So schizophrenia is often characterized by the perception of auditory hallucinations. People hear voices, and they hear voices with great lucidity often. It's a lot of times it's hard for people who have never had an auditory hallucination to imagine that you could hear a voice that isn't really there and hear it as clearly and as really as as absolutely concretely as the voice of somebody in the room. But it can I've read tons of reports. It can absolutely feel like that. Auditory hallucinations can be incredibly convincing and powerful and can have this kind of sway over behavior. Many other things about schizophrenia do seem to line up with some of the phenomenology of what Jaynes imagines would be the bicameral mind. So there's a sort of loss of the ability to narratize the self sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people with schizophrenia have difficulty imagining the self, like the draw a person test. This is a test sometimes used to diagnose schizophrenia where, people who have the condition have difficulty drawing a person.
Then there's the additional thing, for instance, the idea that in some cases people suffering from schizophrenia are able to tickle themselves. Did you hear that one?
No, I haven't heard that, but that seems like it could maybe be compatible with the bicameral hypothesis just because of the division between the hemispheres of the brain that would be implied there.
Mm-hmm. And what's another strange thing about this is that regardless of whether you agree with this idea or whether you disagree, there is no denying that it has influenced the modern world, even if it's untrue, in very strange and meaningful ways. If part of the argument is based on literature and art, the concept of bicameralism itself has been driving literature and art.
Well, not only that, we've talked a little bit about how this hypothesis could be used to explain the evolution of religion, I suppose. But I don't think we've really touched on the idea that when those voices went away, it was negative. It caused anguish.
Traumatic. And this is another thing that ties into schizophrenia. I mean, we often think about schizophrenia as
it's a sense of being abandoned, you know, by your God.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I was saying with schizophrenia, often people don't necessarily perceive all of the voices that they hear during schizophrenic hallucinations as negative. Like sometimes they see the voices as helpful, or sometimes they see them as comforting. Other times they do see them as negative or very distressing. As I would imagine in some cases the bicameral gods could be. Like the gods in this case would have been your own mind. So they would have been as powerful and as various as people's own minds tend to be. So you could have voices that would be very smart and very helpful. You could have voices that are not so smart and not so helpful. You could have voices that are illogical and commanding you to do bad things. You could have voices that are nice. You could have voices that are mean and critical. I mean, just think about how much individuality there is in the way our minds are built. And you can imagine that same thing in the relationship between the bicameral God and the bicameral person. But anyway, if you find your voices helpful and comforting, when they go away, this can be very distressing to you. And Jaynes pulls together a lot of evidence to suggest that when people's gods vanished, when they made this transition from bicamerality to consciousness, it was traumatic for them. Like he cites all this ancient literature of people saying, I want my gods back. He even cites an example from the Psalms where people are saying, my heart pants for you, O gods. Where are you? Come back.
Wow. It makes me think of the fall of man, of Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's how it's explained. It's like that's when it happened.
Yeah.
Right? Like that was literally what caused us to be abandoned. Before that, we were all one. It was he calls it the Elohim, I believe, the great ones.
The Elohim is one of the words in the Hebrew Bible used for the name of God. It's usually translated in modern English translations in a singular for God.
Mm-hmm.
But he argues that really in the ancient context, it should be translated as gods. It is a plural word, but the way I understand it, it could mean singular or plural. And he just says we should translate it plural, you know, how it would be in the ancient context. And it's people talking about how they want the voices back.
Yeah. And just this gets into one tiny thing that we've covered before on this show, which is the possibilities of hallucinogens, the eating of substances in early man, and how possibly that could have played a role in the connection or a separation, you know, a melding of the mind in a way because of things like psilocybin.
Yeah, Terence McKenna, right?
Yeah, yeah. Food of the Gods, Terence McKenna. Some of these ideas are put forth there. It's fascinating stuff.
Grandpa Terry.
I know. Grandpa Terry talking on the ranch, telling everybody what's going on.
I wish you guys had invited Noel and I to hang out with him when you were when you were hanging out and learning his amazing impressions.
I never hung out with Terence McKenna. That would have been great.
Yeah. But it just makes me – sorry. It just makes me think – I wonder if there is something there, you know, if we just for sake of argument take that the bicameral theories are correct and you have these two separate hemispheres and then somehow you're introducing these chemicals that are causing – other types of hallucinations, physical, chemical hallucinations.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, check it out. Philip K. Dick, the sci-fi writer, he was known to dabble in the hallucinogenic arts, shall we say. In fact, I think he kind of like had this like crazy flop house that he owned where people would just kind of hippies and stuff would come through and sleep on the floor and they would share their drugs. And he, you know, there was a period in his life where he just kind of existed, I believe, in a constant hallucinogenic state. And he absolutely adored Jane's book.
Really?
And in fact, he wrote him a letter personally expressing this love of the book and how it really helped him explain some things. There's a trilogy. I think he didn't finish one of them, but there was a trilogy of books, one of which is called Valis that Philip K. Dick wrote, where the character's name is Horse Lover Fat, which Horse Lover, I believe Philip is translated to mean horse lover, and Dick is the German word for fat. So he basically is writing about himself, and in this book, he is narrating it as like an omniscient narrator, but then sometimes switches to where he's talking about himself as though he's the same person that he's narrating about. Mm-hmm. And this the one big part of the story is based on the real thing that happened to him, where he claims that a pink laser from outer space shot into his brain and gave him knowledge of a strangulated testicle in his son that could have potentially killed him. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge that he received allowed him to intervene and save his son's life. And from that point on, you know, again, psychedelics, a lot of that at play. He claimed to hear these voices.
So what did he say in the letter?
Well, it's a long letter, but I'll just read you a couple of parts where he says, "What I did not expect, however, was to find myself under the jurisdiction of an ancient god who commanded me first this way and then that, extricating me from a highly stressful situation I had found myself in. No theory of my own, and for 3 years I have studied and labored to come up with a theory, or by anyone else..." assumingly he means anyone else but you, talking to Jane, could account for the exquisitely beautiful voice, the inner voice, which I heard off and on for 11 months. At first, I told my wife that the Elohim were talking to me. Later, during one of my many hypnagogic dialogues between me and this articulating entity, it also communicated in dreams, in written form. It informed me that Jesus was a name for Zeus Zagreus. However, in most dreams early on, it appeared in the form of Sybil of Apollo, but with a third eye and lateral lens form by which she could see and hence know everything. He then wraps it up with this: "Let me say in conclusion that your superb book has now made it possible for me to discuss my experiences openly without being merely called schizophrenic."
That's awesome. He was even a great writer of letters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heady stuff.
And of course, when we're talking about modern literature, we would be remiss. You can read that letter in full online, correct?
Of course.
And we would be remiss if we did not at least briefly mention Westworld. And Westworld encounters some topics like this. Now, given the show's – given our mutual agreement between us as host and between our audience, we are not going to spoil Westworld for you. But if you enjoy science fiction – you enjoyed this episode, we do highly recommend that you consider checking it out.
If you can afford an HBO subscription or no friend.
Let me spoil it. John Wayne is God.
Oh.
Well, everybody knows that. And hey, hit us up. We'll share our HBO Go accounts or at least
don't
our moms.
Say that.
So in the course of our exploration today, there's another big thing we have to mention. We have touched on a controversial topic, the concept of hearing voices, sometimes called auditory hallucinations. And if you are listening to this and you feel that you are suffering from a condition related to this or similar to this, please know that you are not alone. You are not isolated. And there are organizations around the world that are waiting to support you, to help you. You can call Lines for Life at 1-800-273-8255. You can also check out, if you are someone who both feels you hear voices and you feel at peace with this or you want to explore it more, you can also check out organizations like the International Hearing Voices Network.
Guys, I'm hearing a voice right now. It's super producer Paul, and he's saying, wow, you guys have been recording for like an hour and 15 minutes already.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, you didn't hear that?
I don't think
he's
anybody.
He's talking again. Are you?
I just heard that the crocodile must be fed a bunch of times.
What?
What does that mean?
I don't know.
I have a voice just whispering Zanzibar at all times.
At all times.
Even now. It's very difficult to focus.
It's like a really specific form of tinnitus. It mm-hmm. just sounds
just
like
Zanzibar.
Zanzibaritis
aside, Joe, thank you so much for
Seriously.
Coming on the show.
Thank
you
all for having me.
That
it's
was
been
awesome.
A lot of fun.
This is a very nice dovetail to our earlier episode with Joe on Gnosticism.
Oh, yeah. That one was fun too.
So if you enjoyed this episode, please check out our earlier works on Gnosticism. Joe, you were also on the show when we talked about internet trolling and shills.
Oh, yeah. Paid government online manipulators. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. That's become a little more relevant since we first talked about it, huh?
Most certainly.
No, that's fake news.
So
it's fake news. One thing that is not fake, however, is stuff to blow your mind. If you have checked out our show, if you like our show even a little bit, you are going to love these guys and the topics that they explore. So don't delay. As soon as this podcast ends, click over, check out Stuff to Blow Your Mind, get a deep dive into the bicameral mind.
You know, I was on a very short trip last week, and I listened to your episode on It and the Deadlights.
Oh, yeah?
And I really dug it. I very much enjoyed it.
Oh, well, shout out to my coworkers, Robert Lamb and
Christian
Sager.
That
no, that was Christian who was on there, but they do a great job.
It was great. They talk about, like, you know, Pennywise and the deity from It and kind of they couch it in terms of, you know, predatory behavior and in nature. And it was it was really, really great. I really enjoyed it.
Did you just spoil It for me?
I think Stephen King spoiled it.
So. Kidding.
I'm just kidding. We saw it together. Come on.
We did see it together.
It's true. So the voices in our respective heads are compelling us to end today's episode. However, not the show. We'd like to hear what you think. Is there some sand to this argument? How much? A grain? 2 grains? A heap?
I'm glad you went there. Anything you want to talk about, anything we've covered on this episode, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter, where we're Conspiracy Stuff.
Is a pile smaller than a heap?
I feel like it is intuitively, but I don't know who the authority would be on that.
Well, you know what? If you guys are an authority out there, let us know. Send us an email. Please let us know the difference. It's killing us. You can send us an email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.